This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
BBC Sounds.
Hello, and thank you very much for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen, he's Ewan McElraith, and we're standing at the quayside in Kirkcudbright in Dumfries and Galloway.
It is a beautiful place, loads of wee privately owned shops, surrounded by history. We've got the castle behind me, we've got scallop dredgers in front of us. It's a delightful wee port, but you have to come up river quite far from the sea. We need to take a long look at Dumfries and Galloway, because a lot of folk really miss a treat when they come up the motorway from England. You should turn left.
Dumfries and Galloway is unusual in Scotland in that it has its own kind of cattle, the belted Galloway. Quite a distinctive beast, and a chap who's quite high up in the pedigree organisation behind the breed is John Corrie.
Come on in!
What is this we've got in here?
Two cows, two calves, both show quality, and probably will go out to the local shows later on this year.
It's an utterly miserable day, torrential rain, muddy, muddy ground. They couldn't care less.
They couldn't care less. If you look at them, they have a double coat. They have a wool next to skin, if you feel it, and then on the outside they've got hair. The hair runs the water off, the wool keeps them warm. They're an absolutely natural breed. This is a gene that causes this belt, and I've seen these cattle in Africa, I've seen them in Turkey, I've seen them in Holland, and you also get it in saddleback pigs, goats throughout the world have this belt gene as well.
They have to be amongst the most recognisable of all domestic animals, because basically a black animal with a big white band around the middle. Have they always been like this?
They have, absolutely. They haven't been made like other breeds have been made by crossing. This is one particular gene that this breed of animal have carried, and they've been in this area of Galloway for 300-400 years, as far back as we can trace.
So essentially, effectively a native breed, they'd be good doers in really poor ground.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, these are running in here. They're getting a wee bit of feeding in the morning, but if you look behind us there, there's an old wood, and there they are, as happy as Larry, on this really miserable morning. They will turn really rough, nasty ground into reasonable grazing ground, and they're used in a lot of natural reserves throughout the whole of Britain.
How did you get into them in the first place?
My dad had 66 dairy cows and 150 sheep on here. I emigrated to New Zealand and learnt a lot about farming, came home. Of course, couldn't agree with Dad any longer, so went out to a small farm in Selkirk, came back here. He sadly died very young, and we increased the dairy herd from 66 to 210. And that was the year they brought in quotas, so we got completely caught with quotas. We're having to pour milk away. So we sold off the dairy herd, and I went to buy beef cattle, and the first lot in the ring was 16 belted Galloways. Man said they're not pedigreed, but we can get them pedigreed, and I bought them. And from that, we built up a herd of 167 breeding cows. Biggest herd in Britain, and had a superb time through the 80s and 90s with a stockman called Billy Cloy, who took them out and brought them out beautifully and won every show that there was.
It's almost, you know, people think farming is farming, it's a craft. When it comes to breeding something like this, it's not, it's an art.
Well, it is, and we've got a lot of rules and regulations. Obviously, you want to build a beast that's got the quality meat in all the right places, and these two certainly have it. You want it good over the tail head and down the back leg. You want a good heavy shoulder on them, reasonably deep in the middle. And we've got very strict rules. All the bulls that are going to be pedigreed have to have a DNA test to make sure that we know that it's the right bull going to the right cows when the time comes. We also have to check the belt, and we don't like the belt any further back than just in front of the back leg, and it mustn't go to the front leg. So these belts are just about perfect.
You don't breed for beef. You're basically breeding for stud, essentially.
Absolutely. I'll show you five bulls just shortly. I've just sold one to Coventry yesterday. They will be going for bulls.
One of the things you showed me down in the house was a little sort of like clear plastic envelope with some hair in it. Explain that.
Well, to make sure that you've got the right bull with the pedigree, you pull these hairs, and on the end you'll see little follicles. From the tail head.
Okay.
And you pull these, and you mustn't touch them at all because you can't put your own DNA onto them. So those go off and they are checked. And that DNA marking goes with the bull's pedigree so that you're absolutely sure that you're not actually tricking anybody by selling a bull with a different pedigree.
So basically it's checked against the DNA of the father and the mother?
Absolutely, yes.
All right. How many beasts have you got nowadays?
Oh, we're down to very, very few. Just the two cows. We sold the most of the herd about 2 months ago. My son took one look at the land round here, and you can see it isn't exactly land for large machinery. And he now runs Galbraith and Castle Douglas, so he's a busy man there. I've kept these because I'm vice president of the society this year, and you must have some breeding cows. And I want somebody to get me up in the morning, even in a morning like this.
Do you miss them?
Yes, I do. I miss them very much. It was hard work, but when I had Billy Cloy as my stocksman, he pretty well looked after them. We took out a big show group of senior bull, junior bull, two cows, two heifers and two bulling heifers. And we took those to the Royal Show, the Highland Show, the Great Yorkshire Show and all the local shows. After 2010, I started to show myself. I now do them all myself. But the great thing about that bull was I reared his mum, I reared his father, I bred that calf, I fed it all the way through, I brought it out for the show, and I'd done it all.
John Curry there were what was left of his belted Galloway herd, and I really felt for him. You know, once upon a time, he had the biggest herd of belted Galloway anywhere in the UK.
It's a shame, because they are beautiful animals, and they really fit in with the landscape here. The lush green of Dumfries and Galloway, and that black with the white really stands out. And they're perfectly suited for this environment. You know, they're great meats, they're great producers. Just hard to make a good living off of them because they don't grow so well.
Well, yeah, but I know this is going to put some commercial farmers' noses out of joint. You see some of these big Charleys and things like that, and massively, massively muscled animals. They put on a lot of weight very fast and what have you. And you think, well, yeah, that's fine. But I can't help thinking, one of these fine days, having native breeds like the Belted Galloway or Highland Coos that can take practically nothing on the hillside and turn it into beef is going to prove really useful.
Yeah, and who knows what might happen in the future, how important it might be to have a distinctive Scottish brand. But I've been taking a different look at it. I've been looking at dairy herd. Now, it's run by a farmer called David Finlay, who also runs Cream of Galloway. He's organic. I've met him on about three occasions now. Once 10 years ago when he started out going organic. 2 years ago, he was looking at a really radical way of producing calves and meat. So I went back to find out how he's getting on.
We've got 65... mixed breed cows. So we call them mixed breeds because they're crossbred, using three types of cow, bull.
And these are dairy cows?
These are all dairy cows, and they have their calves with them.
But tell me, traditionally, the model that would have happened with the calves, the male calves, what would have happened?
Well, what we used to do was 24 hours after calving, we took the cow into the parlour for milking. And when she came back out, the calf had gone because we'd taken it to a pen to be reared separately.
And you decided to change that model because, yeah, it was pretty heartbreaking for the calves and the mothers as well. You've changed it. What have you done?
Yeah, well, we could see that there was a distress for the cows, particularly because the calves really didn't know any better, although they knew something was odd. We changed it because, basically, we're open farm here. We get visitors through the summer. We do farm tours every day. And we could see that this was causing quite a bit of consternation with our visitors. And we realised at that time, and this is going back 10, 20 years, that this was an issue that the public were totally unaware of, but it was an issue.
So what did you decide to do? So you better introduce your dogs as well, because they are working up ahead of steam.
This is Meg. Meg likes to exhibit her vocal qualities. Right, so what we decided, we thought, OK, we'll give this a spin. We went to the Netherlands, where they'd been doing some cow-with-calf dairying, keeping the calves with the cows for 3 months and then weaning them. We went and looked at their systems and we thought, well, that's not too difficult. We could do that. The whole farm went. At the time, we were redesigning our whole dairy setup because the old dairy was not fit for purpose. So we built over 4 years ourselves pretty well. Well, okay, we had the electricians and things. We built a new, brand new barn for the cows, in which we incorporated areas where the calves would be able to live as well.
So you've got the mothers here in front of us, eating quite happily, and you've got the calves as well. Now, the reason that's different is you're about making milk, producing milk, and the calves take milk, and that's why they're taken off. How do you square that circle?
Yes, well, it is a bit of a heartbreak. As a dairyman, we are very much focused on getting another litre of milk. So when something comes along that takes away half your milk, that is very distressing. What we found is that we did the experiments 6 years ago, and we found that the calves grew really well. Once we weaned the calves at 5 months, the cows rebounded well, and we were getting 20 to 25 litres of milk from each cow. So what we figured was that with the calves growing so fast and finishing early and coming back into the herd early, that was releasing a lot of forage that they would otherwise have been eating, which we then could fill that space with more dairy cows. So we've gone from 100 to 135 dairy cows. We lose about a third of the milk to the calves, lose in inverted commas, because the calf then is growing very quickly, and we're starting to sell these now into a new market called the Ruby Veal Market, which is Central Belt and London restaurants.
Let's nail this in the head. This isn't the traditional continental veal in crates. This is a million miles from
this. This is absolutely, totally different. These are calves that are growing to more or less full weight. They're coming to 400 kilos at 10 months. They're being slaughtered locally, and the carcasses are being sent down to the butchers. And
you're suggesting it's working. I was down here chatting to you 2 years ago, and you admitted you were struggling a bit financially with the concept of keeping the calves with the mothers.
Yeah, it's been a bit of a struggle. And it wasn't just a struggle for us psychologically and emotionally and financially. The cows also, they have been adjusting. Even from year two to year three, we've just been measuring like-for-like cows, and they're 20% up on last year. So from the first year to the second year, we're 50% up. So the cows are learning, they're adapting to the system, they're accepting it. You can see, I mean, that it's a very calm setup. The first year, it's a lot of stress. So the whole thing is evolving. Also, we've got the opportunity to select cows that fit the systems.
OK, that's that mechanism. But you're also looking at other things in terms of water supply, and antibiotics are an important part of a dairy farm. You've taken a different approach to that.
Yeah. Well, it's really about how can we get these cows and calves to produce to their best? And if there is disease in the environment, then that's going to drag them down. And this is always an issue when you're organic, is how do you cut down on antibiotic use? So what we've been experimenting with over the past year is a system called environmental inoculation, which is basically, it's about taking a benign or friendly bacteria and spreading it around the whole environment in the building where the bacteria...
Well, into the water supply as well.
Water supply, the physical infrastructure
as well. Well, come and show me. You've got a water trough over here. So what kind of bacteria is it?
Well, the bacterium is that we are using is called Bacillus subtilis, which is...
I'm going to take your word for it that it's a good bacteria.
Certainly. Meaningless to me for up until a few weeks ago.
So have you seen changes in the water?
The water's totally different. We used to have to clean the troughs out every 6 weeks, 2 months, the water would be black. You couldn't see the bottom of the
trough. Which is pretty clear. How long has this one been?
Well, this is since the middle of October. So what are we talking about? Two, four, nearly 5 months.
Well, I've seen a lot of water troughs in my time, and they do get mucky pretty quickly. That's quite impressive.
Well, yes, well, for us, that was probably the most visible manifestation of the system. So the bacteria seem to be working. And the whole idea is about flooding the environment, flooding the water with friendly bacteria, is that they gradually knock out the pathogens. And what we've seen is the calves are responding tremendously in terms of their health, because we used to suffer from quite a bit of pneumonia in the calves.
Yeah, but is that not viral?
It is, you're quite right.
Well, how do bacteria fix that?
Well, they're knocking out the pathogens, and it's the pathogens that are dragging down the cows and calves, particularly the calves, because they are vulnerable, and it leaves them vulnerable to other diseases like viral pneumonia.
How much have you reduced your dependence on antibiotics? How much have you improved? How have you changed your greenhouse gases? So many questions.
The whole system, I mean, this is really the icing on the cake. The whole system is based around ecological farming, regenerative farming, so building our soils, building our organic matter in the soils, reducing our carbon emissions through the anaerobic digester, which is turning slurry into useful gas for energy and fertiliser from the digestate. So an estimate has been made, which was something like in the order of 50 or 60% reduction in our greenhouse gas emissions per cow. Our antibiotic usage has been reduced by 90% over that. I mean, this has been a long journey. It's taken us 15, 20 years to get there.
You must be pretty chuffed with it. I mean, these are impressive figures. And this is a happy, relaxed atmosphere. You've got the bull just chilling out over there.
Well, I think it was, Ewan, it was the fact that the ecological thing, once we kind of got a hang of it, you know, it took 10 years to get our heads around it. Once we got the hang of it, what we found was gradually the productivity of the farm was getting back to where it was when we were using all the chemicals. So the big advantage now is that we've got the production, but we don't use the chemicals. So we don't have that huge cost, and we're not putting all this stuff into the environment, which must be good.
David Finlay at the Ethical Dairy there. Now, though, you know, there have changes being made, they're not massively expensive changes.
Not hugely expensive, but a massive change of mindset, because people tend to come out of college with a particular approach to running a dairy. But to make that decision of actually, we're going to leave the calves with the mothers, mm-hmm. we're going to take the hit for a third of the milk off, but there's a trade-off in terms of profit.
Yes.
And reduce the amount of antibiotics and the amount of greenhouse gases you can get by using friendly bacteria in the water as well. That water was crystal clear. Mm-hmm. And the fact that you can spray it in the atmosphere and it reduces the incidence of pneumonia, which is partially viral, because it just competes for that space. It's just terribly, terribly clever. But I'm really pleased for him, because as I said in the piece, I spoke to him 2 years ago and he was struggling to make mm-hmm. it work. Mm-hmm. And all around him were saying, this is nonsense.
Yeah.
And he's still going on. And it's really coming together. And he's also just about to start. He's built the building. He's just making cheese now. And we should go down and try it. I think it's going to be great, because he makes fantastic ice cream. Anyway, enough of an advert for him.
There is heaps to see in the area. Ewan went on to meet a lady called Rowena Flavelle, warden at RSPB Mersehead. Now, that in itself used to be used for dairy cows, but now a very, very different selection of animals can be found there.
We're just stood in the car park at RSPB Mersehead, and we're just looking straight out the back into a dry grassland field that's full of barnacle geese.
It's quite impressive. You just get out of the car and there's thousands more, I don't know, hundreds of geese?
Yeah, there's certainly hundreds at the moment. They're protected species and they're quite used to people and the cars and the car parks. You can get really close to them, get really good views.
Because usually when you get 20 feet away from geese, they're up and they're off.
They are, yes. Not so much at Mare's Head. You can get really good views, just a little compact camera, and you can get fantastic photographs here. You don't need expensive telescopes and high-tech
cameras.
This
is proper wildlife watching for me. You get out of the car and there it is. You're not walking, staying on a hide for 12 hours. It's fantastic. Tell me about, I've been here 3 or 4 times. I mean, just tell me about the reserve, because it's quite a special kind of habitat.
Yeah, it's a very mosaic of habitat. So it was bought by the RSPB in 1993. It used to be a working farm, originally a dairy farm, and then going more into arable. So since the RSPB have took over, we've created wetlands to reverse the decline in breeding waders here. But we still maintain arable rotation. So we grow spring oats for the overwinter stubble. We put wild bird cover crops in as well for farmland birds.
So why do you still farm it? Why not just hand it all over to wildlife?
So we're farming for wildlife, wild bird cover crops. They're all really fast declining habitats in the agricultural landscape. So they're providing overwinter seed for the farmland birds and just encouraging a diversity of species. So we've got wetland species, we've got dry grassland for barnacle geese, and we've got these arable rotation for skylarks, tree sparrows.
It's a real gem of a nature reserve, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
I mean, you're biased, obviously. Yeah,
absolutely.
How popular is it?
It is popular. We sit at around 17,000 visitors a year, so it's certainly not a major visitor site as far as the RSPB is concerned. But within Dumfries and Galloway, it's a fantastic place to come and see wildlife and specific species such as the barnacle geese.
And toads.
Natterjack toads, yes.
Well, tell me a bit more about them, because they're a very rare beastie.
Yes, they're European protected species. They're the UK's rarest amphibian. And in Scotland, they're only found on the Solway coast. And Mershead currently holds the largest sustainable population in Scotland.
So how are they doing? Are they improving?
They're doing fantastically. So we had a big storm surge come in 2014, which at the time we felt had decimated potentially the habitat. And really it's turned things around. So the saltwater incursion has flushed out the habitats and sort of rebooted it. And last year we had over 300 natterjack adult toads on site, over 2,000 toadlets counted in just one day.
That's a really positive story.
It's a fantastic story. Yeah, it's certainly leading the way for natterjack toads.
I was here a couple of years ago and you were trying to buy the neighbouring farm or bit of the neighbouring farm, and you'd quite a big steep price tag on it. How much was it and how did you do?
That piece of land was quite important to the reserve. So in 2003 we acquired some farm fields near West Preston, and so this little bit in the middle really joined up the jigsaw and made it one big reserve. And we had the opportunity to buy it from the landowners at an asking price of £285,000. And within 6 weeks, we'd raised that money solely through donations from our supporters.
OK, you've got your land, a lot of woodland on it. It wasn't kind of where you wanted it to be in terms of a nature reserve. What have you done?
Yeah, so it's around 70 hectares, very rush-dominated wet pasture with a non-native conifer plantation. So we've had that plantation felled, and we're working towards getting that area safe for livestock. We've done a lot of ditch clearing, and by opening up the ditches, getting the water flow, you're able to drain some of that fields and get in and top the rush. So we're now at a stage where we're getting cattle on, and we're aiming in parts of it for wet, boggy habitat, which will be ideal for breeding curlew and snipe, and on some of the higher, drier grounds looking for barnacle geese. And we're already seeing thousands of barnacle geese starting to feed on that land where they were not doing that previously.
How satisfying is that to actually A, get all that money together, B, buy the land, C, transform it, and then the wildlife said, yeah, you're doing okay.
Yeah, it's fantastic, and it's been an aspiration for Mershead ever since 2003, really, when we managed to acquire land to the east of the reserve. So to build it up and have just one really big reserve, it's over 1,000 hectares in total.
What about getting rid of the tree stumps and things like that? Because getting rid of a forest or even a plantation isn't an easy thing to do.
No, so what we've left with really is the felling contractors have taken all the wood away, but we're left with a lot of brush on the ground and the tree stumps. So at the moment we're working with conservation work parties, including some colleges that have come to help us as well in clearing up the brush. And then we're working through the plantation with a 360 digger, and we're sort of digging the stump out and then just flipping it over on itself back into the hole, and that will allow it to just rot down.
So are you putting cattle, sheep back on?
We will do. At the moment, the focus is making sure that area is safe before the cattle and livestock can go in, really.
So is that all done, though? This is finished?
No, absolutely not. It's loads of things going forward. We've put sluices in, so we're starting to get control over the water levels. And certainly our long-term aim is to get visitors out there and be looking at footpaths, possibly hides, and really expanding the visitor view for Mershead as well.
RSPB Warden Rowena Flavelle there at Mershead. And it's just great. You get in the car park, open the door, boom, thousands of geese. just my idea of armchair bird watching.
If my memory serves me right, they've kind of got like a hawthorn hedge or a dog rose hedge.
It acts as a hide because it's about 6 feet high. Uh-huh. So you can go all around the reserve and not disturb the birds. But every now and again, you get a wee gap.
Yeah, well, I was prepared to walk for miles to actually get a decent photograph of geese, but literally came out of the car, there was a hole in the hedge, stuck the camera lens through there, and the geese couldn't care less. It was brilliant.
Yeah, so you'd all be like that. Golden eagles. If you do get a chance to go along there, it is well worth visiting.
Yeah. This area, the southwest of Scotland, is very well known for its rock art. Now, a lot of this is Neolithic. They can be described, it can be located. The meaning of it, however, is an almost complete mystery. I went in search of some with Lisa Allen, who's a Cudbury volunteer with something called Scotland's Rock Art Project.
The light isn't great today.
But I can see them very clearly there.
You can make out some cups here, uh-huh. And then this one has a ring around it. Over here, we've got a large one with lots of really small cups on it. We did count these at one point, and I can't remember, I'm sorry, but there's definitely over 50 there. And in the middle, there is a central cup and two rings around it. It's almost like a boss.
There's a fantastic one there, where it's a bit like someone's thrown a stone into a pool of water and the rings are extending out either way. They're really, really visible, and because it's been raining recently, and it's a low kind of light, which is not usually very, very good, but these things just stick out.
Yeah, and if you imagine when it is sunshine, the sun is shining on them, they're even more impressive. So, yeah, they deserve to be a scheduled monument.
Yeah. I'm just going to describe where we are. We can't see the sea anymore because somebody has put a coniferous plantation in the way. Mm-hmm. But effectively, we're on the end of a ridge, essentially, here in Dumfries and Galloway. And, you know, we're just surrounded by green. This is really farmland. How old are these?
We don't know exactly how old they are. They're very difficult to date because I imagine you can't really radiocarbon rock because it would just come out as millions of years old. But they think between 6,000 and 3,000 years old. So that's pretty old.
So we don't really know who did them either?
No, Neolithic people.
This drives me nuts because you think, what was the purpose of this? Why did? Because this is effort. Why did they do this? What were they trying to signify?
Well, again, that's another we don't really know. And we'll probably never really know, to be honest. There is a project studying that, but they will admit themselves that we may really never actually know the true meaning of them. There was a guy called Ronald Morris who wrote down 104 theories of them, and he gave them marks out of 10 as to probability. Uh-huh. So an example of one that got zero would be messages from outer space. One I quite like as well is that they were a showcase for tattooists. Apparently the Celts were known to have tattoos, so that's one theory. I think that probably actually got a five. So I think that they probably had some meaning, and maybe not the same meaning in different places. Maybe I think perhaps location also had some significance. So
tell me about Scotland's Rock Art Project. What's the purpose of it?
It's a five-year project, so it started in 2017 to 2022, and they're looking at the relationship between the rock art and the landscape and looking at what the possible meanings were, and also how we can use these, the past use and the future use of them as well.
Just out of curiosity, how did you get involved in this?
I went to a meeting at our local Cudbury History Society, given by the Rock Art Project, and they were just in their early days and they were looking for volunteers and they were offering a training day. So I was really interested. The lecture was really interesting and I wanted to get involved. So it's sort of gone from there.
Do you start to spot these things all over the place?
Yes, you start to see rings everywhere. Yeah, I'm forever picking up rocks or making a little detour to where I am because there's an outcrop over there and having a look because there's always a good chance that you might find something in Dumfries and Galloway because it's really a wealth of these kind of cup and ring markings here.
And the people in your team, you know, who are trying to sort of assess all these, are they all as good at finding them or are some better than others?
Well, apparently I have the nose, I've been told.
You've got the nose,
nose. And I have just chanced upon them just by having a sort of like a hunch. I think there might be one here. And just giving the turf a bit of a removal. And I have found one not far from where we're standing now, which we will have to investigate at some point.
No offence, that's a bit witchy. You know, just thinking, I bet you there's one there and kicking the turf and there it is.
Well, you get a hunch after a while. You start to sort of read the landscape a little bit, and you think, looking at where you found them previously, you think, oh, well, that might be a good place, you know. If it's facing the sea, we seem to have a lot that are facing the sea at the moment, so it's just a hunch, really, and sometimes it pays off, sometimes it doesn't.
Lisa Allen and the Scottish Rock Art Project there. If you fancy getting involved in that and actually looking for some of those carved stones, they are looking for volunteers. So just go online and have a shifty. We'll try and put it up on our Facebook page as well, some details.
Yeah, just great to meet somebody who knows so much about their area and wants to share it.
Yeah, the folk are always unbelievably helpful too, which is great. We're going to head off now and meet up with a couple of folk that I last met, I'm trying to think, it must be about 3 or 4 years ago, underneath something called the Ormiston Yew, which is just not terribly far away from Edinburgh. Esther and Warren Sanders. Now, interesting couple. They had took 4 years out to cycle around the world. They came back to Edinburgh. They found it really quite difficult settling there. And they've come down here to set up a business in Dumfries and Galloway. And I'm quite keen to find out why.
Yeah, I think there might be a bike involved.
We came down here for a weekend. We actually came through Kirkcudbright on our world tour. And we came down just for a weekend and pressed our nose against the windows of property sales. And within a few months, we'd moved here, sold the house and moved down here.
Why this area particularly, Esther?
Well, we knew the area was good for cycling, and certain things didn't quite work out for us in Edinburgh, and we just needed to get out of the rat race there. And knowing that this was just such a good place for cycling, it just lent itself to actually come down here and just try to make a new start.
But it's all very well to come to somewhere for cycling. This is quite a tight-knit community. Difficult, you know, it's a challenge to suddenly become part of it. You're shaking your head at me.
Yeah, I do.
So many people do.
No, that was the thing, actually. When we came down here for that very weekend, we talked to a number of people. Now, this didn't actually happen up in Edinburgh. There was a certain loneliness in Edinburgh. And when we came down here, we talked to people in the shops. We talked to people just on the road. And everybody was incredibly friendly.
We came back from the weekend thinking we had more friends here within 2 days than we did in Edinburgh. So,
which is not quite sad in a way, isn't it?
Well, that's what happens when you go around the world for 4 years.
Explain the bikes to me, because, you know, Mark touched on it at the start. You've got a passion for bikes. But how did that start? Why are bikes so important in your life?
Well, I'm a runner, and like a lot of cyclists, my knees gave in. People do. I used to do Munros, marathons, and then had trouble with the knees and came to the bike, and that became the passion at that point. Down here, I mean, somebody has designed Dumfries and Galloway for cycling. The amount of roads, the fact that the hills are not too big, I can take you to some hills, but.
No, you're all right. Yeah. Well, actually, you've got a big, brand new, shiny blue bike, and it's a proper electric bike.
Yeah, this is one of our fleet of e-bikes. E-bikes put a smile on people's faces.
Smile on ours.
Yeah, it's sure. I mean, we had it explained to us. It's like a golf handicap, and nobody complains at those. This is evening up the playing field.
I've got an electric bike as well, and I felt a bit guilty about it to start with.
No, you didn't.
It's becoming so much more mainstream now. There's so many bikes out there saying, hey, it's an electric bike, so what?
Yeah, these will quite definitely put a smile on your face.
Yeah. But the thing is, I mean, aside from cycling all the way around the world, as you both did, I mean, you do sportives and all sorts of things. I mean, you know, it's just stuff that's either stupidly fast or incredibly grueling over a long period of time.
Yeah, that's right. And actually, when we resisted the e-bike for a long time, and then seeing how the development is going in terms of tourism and bike tourism, it just has to be there. And we already saw this going or happening in Switzerland and in Austria and things like that. It's actually Britain that is catching up at the moment. So it's so the e-bike have to be. So when we got these, Warren and I dressed up in tweed, and they were just opening here in the Selkirk. They were opening the Prosecco bar, so off we went from our home, cycling along here, just in tweed and on these e-bikes.
So you've got a recommendation for our first stop. Where are you sending us to?
Well, we're going to go up a small hill, obviously, to the grave of Billy Marshall.
Billy Marshall being who?
We'll find out when we get there, I guess.
All right, fair enough. Lead on, Macduff. How popular has the bike tours been?
last year we had a number of friends actually coming along and bringing groups, so that was really, really good. Dumfries and Galloway is not as well known as it should be, and it's not well known as a sort of cyclist heaven, if you like.
The thing is, you're not going to come to Dumfries and Galloway by accident.
I think historically, because all the attention was for going up to the Highlands, it became the forgotten corner here. And actually, do you want to put on some... go into at least number 3 or maybe number 4. It will be easier for you.
See, my concern is that I would become dependent on it, and I would consider that I always needed it.
But, you know, as long as you get out doing the cycling, then that's fine.
Uh-huh.
Because the big problem is that people don't even get out.
Yeah.
And this certainly helps.
Hello. Right. Like that.
That's great. So you convinced it?
I was convinced about 12 feet away from the hotel, to be honest.
It really glides up the hill, doesn't it?
Yeah. It's what were you set to?
I was 2. I chickened out at the last minute and put up to 3.
Did you? I put mine up to 4.
And delightfully, just a wee short cycle out of Kukubri. So where are we going?
We're going to the grave of Billy Marshall, leveller and king of the gypsies locally.
Already, I don't believe you. But let's go and have a look anyway. This is, as far as graveyards go...
It's a cracker, isn't it?
This is quite distinctive, isn't it? They're big, big gravestones. This must be a wealthy part of the world.
I think there used to be a church up here. And if I'm correct, then Kukubri means basically church on top of a hill.
Uh-huh.
And so this might be the hill overlooking the bay. So that might...
33.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh.
So you can really see the wealth of Kukubri in the past.
I'll get out of here. This is the remains of William Marshall Tinker, who died 28th November 1792 at the advanced age of 120 years, and the top of the stone is covered in luck pennies. 120?
Billy Marshall, according to several sources, none of which confer all come together in the middle, was a prize fighter, a boxer, and then became a military man. He deserted the army 7 times and the Navy 3 times.
So he didn't like it much.
He was a military man when it suited him, a bit like him.
Yeah. So even when he was abroad, the one thing he wanted to do was to get back to the Kelton Hill Fair, and he would desert and make his way back to the fair.
On the quite sensible premise that the enemy would still be there when he came back.
Yeah, yeah. And he must have been hugely charismatic because, he was married 17 times, fathered many legitimate and illegitimate children, 4 of which he fathered beyond the age of 100.
This is just getting silly now, Warren.
It's a good story, though.
It's a very good story.
I would have the brass neck to come up with a story like that.
So this is one of Dumfries and Galloway's unsigned wonders.
Yeah, and the lovely, I'm trying to make sense of it. Is that a ram's horn on the back?
Ram's horn and spoons.
And spoons,
cross spoons.
That's a strange one.
No, but it's interesting because it's 2 different kinds of spoons. And I don't know why there's 2 different types of spoons on that. What's the significance of that?
If you know, you could email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk and
we'll photograph it and stick it up on Facebook.
Why we have cross spoons on a gravestone of a 120-year-old man who fathered children at 100.
You're listening to The Doors on BBC Radio Scotland. This week we're in Dumfries and Galloway, standing here with Esther and Warren Sanders. Now, a lot of the people we're talking to here, we're talking to because you've met them and you like them, you know, and you've become friends with them and things like that.
We're going to split up now.
Yeah,
you're going to do some willow weaving, is that right? Who's that with?
Right, yeah.
Trevor Lead.
Yeah, Trevor Lead. I mean, it's like just massive sculptures made in willow. You probably have seen the stag that's woven in willow.
Oh, the Stuartry Museum?
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
It's a beautiful big stag. It's about 6 feet tall, and it's a real work of art. So I'm quite looking forward to that.
Yeah.
And I am heading off to talk to 2 Orthodox priests.
Yeah, Russian Orthodox priests who just probably moved to the area about just over two years ago, and they bought Bittle Castle.
Okay.
And that's James and Tobias. We came across them in a local magazine, which included the line, if you're passing, do just drop in. So we took them at their word and just dropped in.
We will do exactly the same thing.
We'll try and catch up with you before the end of the programme.
Yeah, if we can. But listen, thanks very much for taking us up here to see Billy Marshall's grave. That's excellent.
You're welcome. Thank you.
My name is Tobias Parker.
My name is James Cavendish. And this promontory we're standing in front of here is the old motte of the Motte and Bailey Castle of Bootle. It's a medieval castle which was fortified by our ancestors about 27 generations ago. And it was besieged in the first and second siege of Bootle during the Scottish Wars of Independence, marking essentially the end of the Balliol dynasty.
You've accidentally answered my first question, which is how on earth do you pronounce the name of your castle?
That's the ancient sort of medieval pronunciation coming from a Norse or Old English word, Bothel. Mm-hmm. We pronounce it Bootle. A lot of the local people pronounce it Bittle or Bootle. It's sort of a...
I've heard so many ways it's pronounced, I thought, I'll just ask them. It's got to be the easiest way of doing it. And this building here?
So that's the tower house, which is largely built between the 15th and sort of end of the 16th century, a little bit into the 17th century. These buildings here that you see were built essentially on the foundations of medieval buildings. So what the tower is built on is probably the original keep. So there's masonry in there that is concurrent or may even predate the building of the Norman motte. But most of it has been rebuilt over the centuries, and so we have about 300 or 400 years of additions and so forth to that area.
Tobias, I'm no expert on built heritage, but I came down the hill there and I looked at it and I thought, ooh, that roof looks interesting, and it looks as if the walls have been damp for quite a long time. And that, what on earth provoked you to buy a castle in Scotland?
My cousin and I were both studying in California for the Orthodox priesthood, and we wanted a property where we could start a mission at a chapel, where we could have some space for some smallholding farming. We could have a building to restore as well and do in our taste, basically. We wanted a freestanding workshop for the letterpress printing and bookbinding. So there were a number of things we were looking for, and we wanted an old property. So the older the better. And for various reasons, this property ticked all of those boxes.
How much did you actually know about the fabric of it when you actually bought it?
Very, very little. I had been on a trip to visit 14 properties in 2016, and I had seen all 14 properties from Norfolk all the way up to Elgin, and then this came on the market about 2 weeks after I got back to California. And we thought, well, this is perfect. It's got a family connection. It's basically what we're looking for. So we bought it sight unseen. The first time we actually saw the building was when we took possession of the keys in April of 2017. When we got here, we were really rather shocked by actually how much had to be done and how much damage there was from water ingress and so forth. But it was all sorted out in a matter of a few months, all the major issues. And so we then have got on with the process of restoring it and decorating it and so forth, and making it a place that the local community can come and see that really reflects its history and its place in the local sort of estimation.
Yeah. Show me around the inside of it, would you? Just duck down in here. Wow. I mean, I am used to low doorways and old buildings, but this is ridiculous. This is fabulous.
So a lot of people think that the reason why the doorways were lower was because people were smaller. Although that's pretty exaggerated. The reason why the doorways were lower was for defensive reasons. So this would have been used as a last place of defence.
And what are you using this area for now?
So this is a chapel now. This is our church here.
Who worships with you?
Well, we get local people from time to time, although we haven't advertised our services yet,
because we've been refurbishing everything to such an extent that we want to present people with something that's a little bit more finished before they start coming in and there's dust everywhere and bits of wood falling and so forth.
We've had retreat guests staying already, and so we're hoping we might get more of those and people from the local area as well, hopefully, who will start to come to our regular services.
I have to ask you about the skull.
There's a skull in a niche in the window there.
Oh, yes. Well, you know, that's sort of a major relic of a medieval city. No, I'm just kidding. it's a Yorkshireman, probably, what age? 1700s.
1700s or so, yes.
And it was something Tobias picked up
when I was a student.
As you do.
Yes.
As you do. So. Nipped out for a packet of fags, came back with a skull. What essentially you've got here is essentially barrel vaulted. Yes. Lovely piece of construction. It's not terribly high, it's about 8 feet high, it's quite dark. The windows, again, are quite low, they're about 3 feet off the ground.
About 4 foot thick walls separating us from the outside.
Yeah, absolutely. But you get this feeling of solidity, of just simple masonry mass surrounding you.
Yes.
While we were standing talking outside, you mentioned the printing press. Can we see that too?
Yes, of course.
Yeah, sure. We've stepped into the what I take to be the printing press area. What is that smell? It's a fantastic smell.
Kerosene.
Is it kerosene?
Well, it'll be kerosene, printing ink, and firewood.
I could smell smoke for some reason.
Yeah. So printing ink has a strong smell. Of course, firewood has a strong smell, and the kerosene that's used to clean things has a smell of its own.
Where on earth did you get these presses from? These are fabulous.
Well, the biggest press here and the oldest, the oldest in design. Yes, the oldest functionally came from the United States. It was made in Chicago. And it's called the 20th Century Reliance Press. It was probably made around 1900.
But in design, it's actually the most archaic of all of them. It's the last descendant, design-wise, of the original wooden standing presses, which would have been familiar to Caxton and to Gutenberg. And by the time this was made, it was basically obsolete technology, and they were built just for proofing on, for doing some poster work. But by that point, production presses, as we have over here, the treadle press, had superseded them for regular printing.
Where did the interest in printing presses actually come from?
Well, originally I wanted to print very large books of chant. Gregorian chant, which a number of people could read from. And I was dissatisfied with, you know, little books which were disposable. I wanted the big books of chant as they would have been used in the 15th, 16th, 17th century. And I contacted quite a famous printer in Berkeley, California, about this. And he said, it's totally impractical. Don't do it. You'll end up spending $10,000 or $20,000 on one book. And you're only going to make a couple of copies, so it'll never pay its way. But if you're interested in religious and liturgical printing, here's the email of somebody who is one of the foremost people in the United States. So I emailed this chap. And he said, well, actually, I'm here in Berkeley, California. And I said, well, so am I. Whereabouts in Berkeley? And we found it was about a 10-minute drive. So I drove over there and discovered that that he's the nicest man, also Orthodox, which was another odd coincidence. So it was perfect. He took me on as an apprentice, and we went 2 years in Berkeley, then we moved over here, and we've been continuing from that point.
We were using his press initially, and then eventually we felt that we wanted our own printing press, so we looked around and eventually found exactly the press we were looking for about an hour's drive away in California, and so we were fortunate to be able to get that and put it in the garage of the priest's house in Berkeley and then bring it with us, along with all our other stuff, when we came over.
It's something that has a permanence, which I think is a running theme with everything we try to do here.
You said right from the start that essentially the pair of you are about 26th, 27th generation down from John Balliol, so there is a heritage there, there is a continuity.
Yes.
How much of what you're trying to do here is about creating a legacy, something that lasts, something that might last for another 26 generations?
Well, we hope that what we do have here in having a small religious community will be something that that lasts down the generations. But our hope is when we have everything done, the restoration, well, which I don't think will ever actually happen, but when we have everything presentable, is to have a property which has something to say about how a large-ish property functioned on a day-to-day level, and also about all of the centuries of occupation that have been here since essentially its medieval foundation. Because I think here we have something of a microcosm of Scottish history, which we hope to fit into and to reflect.
Cousins James Cavendish and Tobias Parker there, and I really can't begin to explain to you how rich, how varied, how unusual that entire place is. Some fascinating stuff going on in there.
You know, that's the joy of this job, is you tend to be jealous of what the other person's doing.
Yeah.
So, well, I want to do that. Why can't I do that?
Well, I want to drive a train.
Yeah, but I got a real treat as well, because I went off to speak. I think you've spoken to him before as well. The guy, Trevor Leet, who does...
The willow sculptor.
And I just found him outside his workshop, looking at his willow.
We're looking at my harvest. I've been cutting it for about a month. It's about 3,000 trees I planted on three different farms, different varieties for different projects I work on. Some of it grows 16 foot in 1 year. That's Salix viminalis, it's a sort of common osier, which I use for living sculptures, which it grows really quickly when you...
It's the kind of thing you see in playgrounds and things like that.
Yeah, kind of stuff. And also for bigger sculptures for the framework. And then there's down to La Purpurea, which is a very quality fine willow. Grows to 5 or 6, sometimes to 8 foot. It's slower to grow, so it's a denser wood. And it's great for fine basket work, really.
And you've got this lovely big cross behind us here.
Yeah.
It's quite impressive.
it's one of four for a film project. The metal one is going to be burnt several times, so you can just add stuff to that burning material and it'll look like it's burning from a distance. And then there's three more to make, so you can get different angles as it's burning.
Well, let's go inside your workshop. We'll just go in here. It's lovely, sister.
Well,
it's a mass of willow.
It's a bit of a mess, I'm afraid, at the moment.
It's great. It's lived in, it's worked in.
Winter time of projects going on, and... So it sometimes is tidier, but yeah, most of that willow which is outside will come in here once it's seasoned.
So how did you get started in making willow sculpture?
Well, I first moved up to Galloway in mid-1970s and worked on a farm with a group of, I was a hippie, and a group of my friends. We moved up here from the south, and then I realised that farming wasn't going to be a great future for me, and I was really interested in craft work, always have been, and... I heard of a basket maker over in Brampton in Cumbria that was kind of retiring, so I went and worked with him for a while, making mostly fishing creels. And then I went up to the Isle of Egg to be a basket maker on the craft island up there, and ended up working for the estate, the landowner running the estate. Beautiful island, it still is a very amazing place. And then moved back to Galloway in 1990 and started working with Alex Rigg, who's a great friend of mine, who's a performance artist. And we did a lot of big sculptures for processions. And then the Wicker Man Festival started not far from here. We got to make the Wicker Man every year, which was burnt ceremoniously every year.
Well, what's that like? I mean, most people will have seen the Wicker Man being burnt. Isn't it a double-edged sword? You put your heart and soul into this, and then somebody sets fire to it.
The first few were definitely it's a bit of a shock when you see it go up in flames after 3 weeks' work, and it's gone in 15 minutes. But there's maybe 20,000 people watching it. It gets great publicity. It's quite moving visually to see it go, because we made quite beautiful sculptures, really, really sort of great moving figurative things. And it was the highlight of the festival. And we got to make another one with our own design. It's changed every year. We made some in Edinburgh Hogmanay, and we made also in Aberdeen at Archaeolink. We used to make one up there for Halloween every year.
And you've done some for Outlander, or you haven't?
Yeah, I've done some things for Outlander, yeah. I dip in and out with them. I made a stag last year, yeah, and there's some other projects on the go for this
country. So is that a growing area of work for you, working in film?
We've made a wicker tree. There's a film follow-up to The Wicker Man, was a wicker tree, which was just outside Edinburgh. We made the figure for that. But I just never know what's coming in. I've gone over to Brittany in April to make two sculptures in a castle there. A big wishing tree is one of them, and a spirit of a flower is another one. So that's quite interesting. And then my baby Killane Castle later on this year. You never know what's coming in.
You touched on the fact it was a lot of form, a lot of movement. And I'm looking at just two examples at the moment. You've got some reddish-black wicker and then a really straw-coloured one intertwined.
Yeah.
It's just screaming tango, full of movement.
Yeah, it does. It's a sculpture. It was an exhibition I did, and it's a sort of love, really, because it's called Let's Dance, actually. It's on a heart shape there. Yeah, and it's spiralling round two figures out of one figure, really, yeah. So it just lends itself to figurative sculpture because it's like, if you imagine you take your skin away and you're covered in tubes, wires and tendons, and it's also a bit like drawing with a pencil. So each piece of willow becomes like a pencil line, so you can shade in areas and heighten certain muscles, features.
Now, this thing is a thing of beauty. It's elegant, it's full of movement. The one up there is more scary wicker man type, whether it's a man or a woman or not. But it's
androgynous, really. It was a figure. It was actually juggling at one stage, and it was on a pole up in the air. It was for Spring Fling. I do a open studios event. Well, it's all through Galloway. There's an open studios event every year, and that used to be outside my workshop as a sort of visual. Come in, have a look, see what's going on.
Do you get that sensation as you're mixing the willow, and suddenly there's a form there? You get a kind of odd feeling. Actually, this is a being. This is taking over.
Well, I normally draw out what I'm going to do, but yeah, things do take on their own form organically as you're shaping it up. But I try to work to a design in my head.
So, what are you working over here? Move over.
This is another one of the Celtic crosses.
This is a Celtic cross.
So, for this one, it's got a steel armature which I've welded up. It's going to be burnt, so there's some netting at the bottom there, and I'm just starting on the main shaft part at the moment. Then on top of the cross will go on later on.
And a big star and even up there?
Just a Christmas star, falling off the wall at the moment. Yeah, it's just a Christmas decoration, yeah.
So do you get fed up with doing this? Do you still make baskets?
Yeah, occasionally. I mean, I do make them, sure, but it tends to be more sculptural work. I mean, I make small animals and all sorts of deer, but I still do. I must make coffins from time to time. People ask me to make coffins, whatever. But if I've got time to fit things in.
So is there a big demand for coffins? Because imagine that'd be a great week.
it's a very big demand. I mean, I could, like undertakers have asked me in the past to make them coffins, and I've just become a coffin maker, which I don't want to be. But I've made probably about 20 or 30 for various friends. There was one guy in Northern Ireland had one, this is a few years back now, and he was as tall as me, he was 6 foot plus, and I made this big coffin for him, sent it over to Ireland. And he got back to me and said later on that he'd used it for his great aunt who died, sadly. And she had a collection of 40 teddy bears that all went in the coffin with her. So I was used to imagine that in some future time this grave had been exhumed and there'd been 80 glass eyes staring at them.
What went on here?
What went on here, yeah. Pagans.
The superb willow sculptor, Trevor Leet there.
Yeah, you've met him before and it's just awesome. The movement. The beauty, almost the romance of some of the figures he's got is just astounding.
There's something about willow, because it's quite thin and whippy, it's a bit like somebody's sketching very fast with lots of lines. You get that sense of movement.
Well, he was telling me that it's like a drawing. You're doing it with a line, but you're actually doing it with a bit of willow. Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Yeah. And then setting fire to it, that must break your heart.
I couldn't bear it. Because I spoke to him about that and I said, you know, surely. He says, well, I know it's what it's for. And I said, yeah, but even so, you know, just to watch it burn down to a pile of ashes, all that work, all that talent.
The one positive thing, as he was saying in that piece there, is it looks fantastic. Yeah. And your work is up there before 10,000 people. So there's a bit of trade off there.
Yeah. Anyway, we've come to another part of Dumfries and Galloway. This is Threave. It's a National Trust for Scotland property. One of the things it's known for, it's exceptional for, is the fact that young people, not just young people, but people are trained in the skills and practices of heritage gardening. And you can see the results all about you. Michael Laurie is the head gardener.
It's really a garden within a garden. It's originated really in the 1960s. All this was parkland, really fields. There was nothing here, and it was designed by students for students. So the garden is like compartments. We've got likes of the peat walls here, we've got rock garden, we've got woodland gardens, we've got heather beds, we've got the walled garden. Lots of different features in the gardens for training the students.
This has got a vaguely Japanese feel to it, but there's certain things that kind of jump out at you. Just as we came around the corner, a grey heron took off the surface of this pond, you know, which would have just made it look absolutely perfect. But there's a lovely little sculpture of a bat.
It is. It's the significance of what we've got here, the mixed wildlife that we've got within the garden. And the bats are another great feature that we have here. We've been the only reserve, really, in Scotland. And this just symbolises to the public when they come in that they can, at night time, you can come down here on a walk and you can see them skimming the surface of the water.
Yeah. It's got a real Japanese feel to this, though, because you've got bamboo growing up at the side, you've got a Japanese red lacquer bridge up at the top. Yeah. One of those, I'm never terribly certain what those were meant to be for, like huge incense burners or something.
It is. It's just a symbolic statue, really, for significance of the Japanese-style garden. Mm-hmm. It gives that ambient kind of feature in the area.
You're we've got these. It up.
Well, these acers as well, and we've got the tall gunnery here, which grows up.
I wondered about that.
That grows up to about 10, 12 foot tall, huge big leaves. It's like a giant rhubarb. Mm-hmm. Kids love it to hide underneath it, especially on days like this. It would be beneficial.
It's a real architectural plant, that gunnera. I always think in terms of the island of Gia. Gunneras, I mean, just the gardens, the ditches are full of the stuff. Ditto camellia. There's just something about this area. I mean, has it got a particular sort of climate?
I think it loves the wet weather that we have. It really does. The soggy, really wet ground, it suits it well. And as you see, it thrives here at the side of the pond. I don't think we really need all that extra water, but it really works together in this area and gives us that feel. Yeah. Freshness in the summer when it starts growing.
Threave is a centre for what's known as heritage gardening. Uh-huh. Explain that.
Heritage, what we try and do is we preserve the skills that was taught to us and the generations before us, and things like double digging, pruning within the garden, all these are taught, the vital skills that we need to pass on to the future gardeners. It really does benefit a gardener to be taught with these heritage
skills.
To know
how to load a barrow, that kind of thing.
Yeah, all the simple little things, the aging to the weeding, to putting the potatoes in is a great thing. Just the old ways as well are sometimes, I find, a lot better.
And the students that come through here, where can they practice those skills nowadays? You know, once they're qualified from here, because there's less and less money going about.
Yeah, well, we're finding we've never a problem with any of the students after they leave here. There's so many gardens, and we hope to retain a lot of the students, which we have been doing within the National Trust for Scotland, and that's really our main ethos. But some of the students go on from here to Wisley and Kew, and we have got quite a few students presently.
Well, that's like it's kind of black belt garden.
Yeah, and the botanics as well. The Edinburgh Botanics that they'll go on to further their education, really, and gather more qualifications to set them up for the future. But students from here in the past have went on to be head of the botanics, and we've had certain gardeners went down to the Eden Project who was in charge down there. So we've all over the world, we're known for what we do here at Threave.
What does it mean for a gardener like yourself to have this as a canvas? Because in a sense, gardening's a form of painting.
It is. And this to me, I've been here 15 years now, and this, every day walking around the garden, I find something new. It's always evolving, this type of garden that we've got here. We're not historically dated as with other trust gardens. We can keep changing, we can keep moving things around, and we can keep the students really inspired with new designs and new techniques and that, which is really good. And I think for me, that sums it all up, that we can keep changing things around and freshening things up.
Big responsibility, though.
It is, but I enjoy it, and it's a great team, so it's a great challenge.
Nadine, you're one of the instructors. Where do you actually begin when you get folk walking in through the door?
Well, it depends on what level they're at. We get a variety of students with different levels of abilities, practical and theoretical. So normally my first thing is to have a chat with everybody and see where they're at. What we try and encourage is, like, no question is stupid.
Joking aside, that is our philosophy too. There is no such thing as a stupid question. If you don't know, ask.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And I'd say 98% of the time I know the answer to their questions.
Yeah.
The other 2% of the time, either I'll go and look it up or they go and look it up for me.
Connor, you're one of the students.
I am indeed.
Why? Why did you come here?
I always had a passion for the outdoors. I mean, I worked in retail for 5 years and decided to do quite a drastic career change. Like, yeah, it is definitely. And done a wee bit of work in the forestry, took a forestry course at the Barney, and then decided to enrol here. and one of the best decisions I've ever made. Mm-hmm. Definitely.
How have you found it so far?
Very interesting. They go into quite a lot of detail, keep you up. The standards is pretty high, which is what you'd imagine for a garden like this. Learned a lot in this past nearly 2 years now, year and a half I've been here. So,
see, there's an awful lot of non-vocational courses where you go for 3 or 4 years, you learn. At the end of the 4 years, you step outside and you forget everything, because there's no point. Yeah. Gardening's not like that. It's going to be a continuous process for the rest of your life.
It is, yeah. I don't think you ever get to the stage where you're completely competent in what you do, because you're constantly learning. I mean, the discovering plants left, right and centre, and, you know, just the difference that you can do, you know, and the variety of the jobs that you can do within the trade. You know, it's, you can do specialists, you can do grounds, you can do walled, glass, you know, it's just such a variety of different jobs. So I think that's the joy of it, really, because going from doing a job that I'd done previously, it was quite monotonous, you know, doing the change every day, something different. So it's quite refreshing, you know, to come in and actually do.
Mm-hmm. We haven't picked a particularly good time of year to come and see the garden, and the garden's not officially open yet. You know, there's daffies across there, whole serried ranks of them heading up towards the house, waiting to come out. There are some out. You've got some narcissi here and things, camellia, a few bits and pieces.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Paint the picture for me. When this is out in full bloom, what's it like colour-wise?
Oh, just amazing. May time is one of my favourites, because you can't really walk very far without seeing something else in flower. There's the blue Mechanopsis up the further up the garden. The azalea beds at the top are just a riot of colour, like you cannot even believe. And then even like having just plants that stay green most of the year just gives the other stuff a really great backdrop.
This is, you know, we're sitting here just on the brink of the ticking time bomb of spring.
Yes.
Everything's just about to go bang, you know, and erupt, essentially.
Yep.
It's exciting.
It is really exciting. And this year, there's a lot of plants that are much earlier than normal.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me.
And so it's sort of giving us a taster of what's yet to come.
Yeah.
So, yeah, spring here is amazing. Yeah. Absolutely, just one of the best places.
Michael, Nadine and Connor, just some of the talent behind the really quite stunning Three Garden.
So you're going to redevelop the stately home at home?
No. I must confess, this part of me would like to be a good gardener, but I'm not. You know, I don't know who does the gardening in your place, because your garden's much nicer than mine.
I lose interest after 30 seconds and find somebody else to do. And think, what I really need is a garden railway in here.
On your headstone will be the two words, bored now.
Yeah, moving on. Yeah, but you're doing the gardening stuff, but there's also loads of wildlife here, and this place apparently is hoaching with bats. Dave Thompson's the guy in charge of it, and it's really quite interesting, because everything they do here is determined by how the bats will react to it. It's fascinating stuff.
But right now, at this very minute, we're sheltering under a kid's playground.
We're actually here to look at bats, and there are bats everywhere here in the gardens, but it is chucking it down at the moment. So we've taken shelter at a little child's playground, which is slightly bizarre, but would bats use this?
Actually, yeah, I don't see why not. It's a good place where they could come at night, find a few places to stop and eat if they've caught any insects. Yeah, it's a good spot.
So what's the situation with bats at the moment? Are they mainly hibernating?
At this time of year, yes, they'll be hibernating, but some will, if the weather's quite warm, they might come out of hibernation for short periods, just to get some feed into them, some insects.
And you see, because I was out the other night, when we had a warm period before winter came back, and there was two just patrolling outside the house, about 100 yards up and down, back and forward.
Ah, well, if it was just coming dark, they might have just left a roost, so they'll spend a bit of time getting acclimatised, and then they'll leave that area and go off foraging.
Okay, that's my bats. Let's talk about your bats.
Hi.
How good are the gardens here for bats?
Well, the gardens itself, if I were a bat, I'd love to come and live here. You've got it all, really. You've got trees, which they can use for roosting. You've got old buildings, which they absolutely love for roosting. You've got areas where they can forage. So there's pond areas, longer grass areas. Plenty of linear features, that's what they use for navigation, so a really good spot.
So how many bats have you, well, it's probably a difficult one to say how many bats you've got, how many species have you got?
Well, for a long time we had 7 that we knew of, out of, at that time, 9 species, but it's now 10 species in Scotland. But now, last year, we just discovered that we had an 8th species.
That's quite impressive, I mean, that's bat capital of Scotland.
Yeah, it's pretty good, but I do know there's other places that's got more. But
any indication of numbers? Because bats were doing pretty badly for a while.
Well, in some of the roosts here, yeah, we've got quite high numbers, so up in the hundreds, so that's really good. And as for the other roosts, you know, you'd have to go and spend all night counting them coming in and going out.
So there with your bat detector. Do you have to manage the property for bats?
Yeah, and I'm working really closely with other members of staff here. So as it happens, last year we started our own NTS bat group here at Threave, so that's just specifically for staff. That's myself, the building surveyor, facilities manager, and visitor services supervisor. So between us, we're planning what works are coming up, the best times to do it, and also we're managing areas, keeping these linear features, keeping these areas along grass, retaining any dead wood, you know, that's suitable for habitat.
Presumably all the building work that goes on, you've got to be seriously bat friendly as well, because presumably a lot of contractors aren't quite as geared up as maybe you are.
Well, actually, yeah, we do have to be on the ball. You know, we're a conservation charity, so we want to be doing that anyway. But so the building surveyor, facilities manager and the VSS and the gardens team will come to me if any work's going to be going forward. So any tree work, any work going on in the buildings, and we'll find the best way of doing that.
Is that a change in approach for many organisations? Because I'm guessing a lot of people didn't even give bats a thought.
I would definitely say it's a change in approach, because the law says that it's illegal to destroy a bat roost. So if you're fined for that, you're in a lot of trouble.
And a lot of private individuals, once they discover they've got bats in their loft, the first thing they want to do is get rid of them.
They do, and that's when education comes in. You know, here at Threave, you can come and do bat walks, school groups, and people can actually come and do self-guided walks as well, so down by the river.
Well, you get out there with your bat detector.
Yeah, so they can hire a bat detector, follow this trail. Along the trail, there's way markers, and on these numbered sites is where you might hear a particular type of bat.
Do you think the attitudes are changing to bats? I've got bats in my loft. Fantastic. There are people changing. They're welcoming bats on us. That might be naive.
Well, I would say if anyone came to me and said they've got bats, they usually start off being a bit cautious, but I can generally talk them round into it, because having them's quite an exciting thing.
The fabulous bats of Threave.
Yeah, they're great, and that's, you know, be proud of your bats, that badge of honour thing. I've got bats in my house, that's a great thing, don't get rid of them. Hey, you'll end up in jail, and just bats are great, you'll enjoy them.
Last time we had a bat in the house, there was one in our small living room, and my wife shouted instructions on how to get rid of it from three locked doors away.
Well, we had three in the bedroom last spring. Yeah. They're great, just open the window or shoo them out. Lovely wee things.
Well, what I found with this one was it had to get exhausted. It basically just tired itself out, landed on the curtains. I gently picked it up, put it outside. No, it wasn't a matchbox. It was actually a tea towel, very gently in the tea towel, and took it out. Anyway, keeping the nocturnal theme going, however, Dumfries and Galloway has a dark skies park in it. Now, we'll explain what that is just in a second, but Keith Muir from Forest Enterprise is the guy that kind of dreamt this up in the first place. Explain it. What is a dark skies park?
A dark sky place is a place where we protect the nocturnal or nighttime environment. We try and reduce light pollution and try and make it the best place for humans and all living things to exist in.
How did you come up with the idea? Because it's really taken off.
Well, the idea actually has come from the International Dark Sky Association, which is an American-based place to do just that. But our designation came through and came out of the International Year of Astronomy, when we were approached as saying, would you like to become one? Because it would be a real good way of topping off the year if we managed to get this designation. And that was done because we were all already in an intrinsically dark place, and astronomers were coming here already with their telescopes. We wondered why our parking meters had strange readings on them in the middle of the night, and lo and behold, they were people with telescopes.
You had your suspicions.
We had our suspicions.
To be astronomers.
But it was astronomers. but the key thing was it came out of that, and we had to do it differently from what we'd done. We became the fifth in the world at that time, and up until then, it was all American-based places, and they were all doing it on the back of changing lighting codes and the like. We couldn't do that. We have no statutory rights to control lighting in the place. So
do you not have wardens like Hodges going around?
That's not what it's about, though. You've got to get into
a lovely image.
Well, yes, we've got Dark Sky Rangers who are much better at doing that in a much friendlier way. But the whole point for us was we don't have any control, statutory control over these things, but what we could do is actually flip it and use it as a tourism angle, because obviously it's darker in the middle of winter. Winter's when people tend to not go out in the countryside. It would benefit the region, was our thought, and bingo, we hit on something that was great. And every dark sky place around the world since has followed our way of doing it.
That's interesting. There is a metric for measuring how dark is, a sky quality meter.
That's correct.
Where does this sit?
On a scale from 1 to 25, 1 being in the centre of the sun, getting cooked and bright and you can't do anything, and 25 being in the middle of the Pacific Ocean in a black bag in a black room, we sit at about somewhere between 21 and 22.
That's pretty good. I mean, what did you have to do for that? Did you have to get the council to stop putting spotlights and searchlights on buildings? What did you do?
Well, we had to do a number of things as Forest Enterprise Scotland, because it was all on our land holding. Therefore, with the exception of a few private properties which are interlinked farms and leases like that, we went around our land, and of course it's trees, and trees don't have lights on them, so that was good, so there was no lights. Any of our buildings, we had to make dark sky friendly. Mm-hmm. And then we wrote to all our neighbours and said, would you like to be part of this? And we kind of helped them to understand what that meant. That doesn't mean to say to switching off all your lights. It means you get the right light to do the right job, and then you install it correctly. And you'll see it around the place, that you'll see lights on the outside of buildings all angled at about 45 degrees because they want the light to go away out there. When actual fact, lighting should be always put at horizontal. And if you need it to go further out, either get another light on the other side to do that, or lift it higher up to get the beam to go out further. But don't angle it, because then the light's going up.
That's all very well, but I mean, how do you get councils to do that with these big bright orange lights?
That's an interesting move, because basically from when we did it, we kept one village, Glentrule, within the Dark Sky Park. We did that purposely because it's a very small village. There's only 23 streetlights in the whole place. But we decided that they were the old sodium lights. And we said, we'd like to try and demonstrate that you could, through persuasion, you could actually change people's hearts and minds. So we ran a few events in the old school there. And we said, we'd love to do the stargazing right outside, but we can't because of the streetlights. And the locals, the residents of Glentrule, then came together and said, yeah, we'd like the lights changed. So we got a lighting engineer in, specialist engineer, who came up with a lighting model for that, specifically for that village. And overnight, when it got changed, you could see the Milky Way and the stars from Glentrule, from the middle of the village.
Yeah, that's lovely.
Even with the street lighting, the LED street lighting, you can still see it.
In certain places, obviously, if you're standing underneath the street light, you can't see it. But if you go into the middle of the village where there's a part in the green, you can see up, you can see the stars.
What about, you mean, you're talking about the visual impact of it. What about the economic impact of this? Because I mean, it's 10 years on. 2009, it was kicked off. Here we are, 2019, etc. Have you noticed an economic benefit to this area?
Yes, we did. We have done an economic impact study. It was back in 2013-14, so it's not as up to date as I'd like it. But even then, it stated in the impact thing that at that time we were generating, on the back of dark skies alone, £500,000 additional income into the local area. What they said was that they would expect it could reach £1 million or just over if an observatory was installed and if we had dark sky rangers. Both are now in place.
But I'm not getting this. So if people come out of the cars and look up there, Saturn, great. How are you going to make money out of that? You're not charging folk for it.
No, it's free. That was a strange thing. How do you sell something that's free?
Well, it's quite easy, I would have thought.
Well, it is if you got the gift of the gab. But the bottom line is, the businesses we enter, the accommodation providers primarily get out of it. And if you think of all the accommodation providers that then buy their local food locally, all the people who come down and stay have to get fuel, they have to buy out all the time. We have the Dark Sky Rangers who charge for people to come onto it. When we have events, we charge for events we come. That's a small part of it. It's all the chain that goes into that impact. They're enjoying the park during the day, which is fantastic, seeing all the wildlife and all the trees and everything else. And then at night going out and enjoying what's happening at night time, getting another star.
Your rangers, are they helping interpret? I mean, I can look at the night sky and probably do about 6 or 7 constellations, but there's so many out there. Are you adding that extra value?
Yeah, that was the whole purpose of coming up with the Biosphere Dark Sky Rangers. what they do is they're completely freelance, they're not employed by us. We train them on how to talk about darts guys, and they bring it to life. So they've all got a slightly different genre. Some do photography, some tell the tales of the Greek mythology and bring it to life around fires. Others bring stories of environment and also then link stars to the age. Like if a star is 400 light years away, they'll tell you the light that you're looking at now left there 400 years ago. What was happening? Person standing here 400 years ago was Robert the Bruce or whatever. They'll make that linkages and it brings it to life. So people are beginning to relate to what's up there and they're just telling the story. But more often than not, just getting out into the darkness, people go, I've never appreciated this.
One last thing from me. You brought this image. Explain this to me because it's beautiful.
This is an image that was taken by the Cassini spacecraft when it went to look at Saturn. On a particular day, it was asked to turn round and take a picture looking back towards Earth. And what you can see, apart from the rain splatters, is basically Saturn and its rings. There's a big white dot up there. Yeah. That's one of the moons of Saturn. What is really hard to see is that there's a tiny wee speck down the bottom right-hand corner, which looks like a bit of raindrop, but actually clearly rain away. There's a tiny wee speck, which could be a mix-up with a picture. It's tiny. That's Earth.
Wow.
It's literally the size of a pinhead.
We're not that important, are we, in the scale of things?
And I tend to tell people this, even my guys at work, I've kind of talked to them when they've got lots of problems. I bring out this picture and I say, well, you know, everything's on that. That wee dot has everything on it. How big are your problems now?
How would you say it's been? Has it been successful? Because you and I talked 10, 11 years ago up there. I thought, I've been bad at many projects. Glen Tress, I thought, what a stupid idea. How people are going to go mountain bike up a hill? And I was sceptical about your project. How successful would you say it's been?
It's been hugely successful. There's a number of ways to measure that. You can measure it by the number of hits we get on our website, the number of questions we get, the number of people that keep talking to us about dark skies. You then measure about the economic impact that it's having for a small area. We only have a population of 100,000 people in Dumfries and Galloway. So something that brings that amount of money back into it and increasing is good for us. And then there's the other aspect, which is, have we actually made an impact over the 10 years that has said, have we kept the light pollution under control? And the answer to that is yes, if not improved it. And we're doing all the light meeting readers just now to actually demonstrate that. So these are the plus things. And then you look around you, here's a brand new visitor centre that was built 2012-13. It's dark sky friendly. All the lighting you see here is dark sky friendly. We promote dark sky friendliness, eco-friendly. We look after the environment. Our whole organisation is about looking after the land and the manners that we work on in an environmentally sustainable way. And that, to me, is all the plus signs you need to say. Thing. You can pout off and say, OK, I'm not seeing lots of people here tonight and I don't see thousands of cars. When I was out last week doing the light meter readings, we had no moon, beautiful stars. Every car park I went to, there was at least two or three cars parked in it looking at the stars.
One of these days we're going to come to Dumfries and Galloway, a designated dark sky area, and actually see the stars.
But it's a great idea. It's a great project. Mm-hmm. I just love the concept that you can create an attraction, a destination out of almost nothing, with just the natural things you have on your doorstep.
Yes, quite. And the thing is, most people don't realise how really, really dark can be.
Proper dark.
Proper dark.
Oh. The darkest I've ever had was down a mine in Moncton Hall. We were down there and the guy switched. He said, switch off your torch. You will never experience darkness less. Yeah. It was dark as you can touch, but you get a sense of it. Yeah. In the forest apart, you know, it's great, but it's been really quite informative being able to cherry-pick people's brains to see, you know, who are the interesting people in town.
Yeah, it's actually quite a nice way of doing this. Well, Warren and Esther Sanders, the folk that lent us the e-bikes, have offered us a cup of tea, and somewhere up here there is a bird hide. We'll see how it goes.
Oh, but it's been a great wee journey. I quite enjoyed it.
Yeah, and a lovely part of the world to come to.
We come from Aberdeenshire, and at the moment, it's all brown and ploughed, getting ready for the barley. There's nothing wrong with that. But you come here, it's just so green.
Yes. Everything, I mean, the forest that we're walking through at the moment has got a dry-stained dike.
Well, you wouldn't know it.
Well, you wouldn't know the stones behind it, because it's just thickly cushioned with moss. And, you know, somebody said to me years ago down here, ah, well, that's Dumfriesshire for it's the green. You know, it is because it is so wet here that it is so green.
Aye, but I mean, even looking at these logs, they're still quite white, so they're obviously cut in the last couple of months, covered in green moss.
Yeah.
lifts your spirits a wee bit.
Yeah, it's restful too.
Aye. I can see a Kelly kettle though.
Aha. Enjoy. Okay. Oh, you're going down the traditional route. Birch bark fire lighter.
So we're going flint and...
We are flint, yes.
Excellent.
I mean, there is a pure joy in starting a fire from a spark.
Do you want to do it?
No, I've spectacularly failed at this before.
Have
no,
you?
No,
oh, make, no, him, make no him do it, make him do it.
No one has ever failed.
Yeah, there's a way to hold it. So how this is basically where the thumb is. And then you just press against it and then you push it. Just try this first.
Before you do it?
Yeah.
What's the score, folks? I'm guessing it's going to take him five goes.
I think he'll give him one.
Never!
No, honestly.
One. Two. Yay! Yay! Three, there you go.
That's quite impressive.
Yeah.
So we put the top of the Kelly kettle on.
These are fabulous things.
You maybe should explain the Kelly kettle for those poor souls that don't know what it is.
About Kelly kettle or Irish fisherman's kettle, which you can already hear roaring in the background. So it's a firebox, a circular firebox at the bottom.
It's like a double-skinned chimney, and the water's within the double skin. But these things, they reckon you can boil a pint of water in about a minute, just with some twigs.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that.
So I've got something else for you to try if we get this going. We've got a guy here, Mark, who's doing foraging on his Facebook page. He was talking about the Rose Bay Willow Harp tea. So I got the leaves. So I've drank it before. It didn't kill me. So
so there's basically dried green leaves floating in the top of the... That's actually really nice. No, I really like that.
Well, I have to say this has been an exceptionally good trip. I've enjoyed this.
Well, all the trips are great. They're all different. And it's just great meeting so many different people. And the joy of coming back saying, I didn't know that. I didn't know Billy Marshall found the children at 100 years old. It's great. Thank you very much.
There's hope for you yet. Esther, Warren, thank you both very much. And thanks for the loan of the bikes too. That's been a bit of a revelation too. Every time I try an electric bike, I think what excellent idea this is.
And you know it's all downhill from now on.
Warren and Esther Sanders. Every time I see one of those Kelly kettles in operation, I think this is cracking fun.
It's just, I like the tea as well, which really surprised me. But great to meet folks who are so enthusiastic about their newly adopted home. Lovely. Yeah.
And great that they're making so many friends too. Anyway, that's all we've got time for in this week's Scotland Outdoors podcast. Join us next week again for another one if you can. But from all of the team here in Dumfries and Galloway, thanks for downloading us.